Carl Sagan's daughter arrives with her great new book this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Sasha Sagan grew up around the Planetary Society and with parents who loved science and shared that love. Now it's her turn, and she has created something unique. We'll meet her in moments, and you'll get your chance to win for Small Creatures Such as We, that's the book, when Bruce Betts drops by for this week's What's Up. We'll begin with a few items from the current edition of The Downlink. It's Planetary Society Editorial Director Jason Davis's roundup of planetary science and exploration news. Here's a milestone toward the next great space observatory. The James Webb Space Telescope deployed its 5-layer heat shield under its giant mirrors for the very first time. You can see a shot of the successful test at planetary.org/downlink. The privately funded Breakthrough Listen project that we've talked about on Planetary Radio is going to point antennas at the exoplanets discovered by TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, because if you don't listen, you won't hear. And China's U-22 rover has woken up for its 11th two-week lunar day of exploration across the far side of the moon. There's much more to catch up on, all with links to learn more at planetary.org/downlink. You could easily be forgiven if you envy Sasha Sagan's childhood. She grew up with the love, guidance, and encouragement of Carl Sagan and his collaborator, partner, and wife, Andruyan. They instilled in her the sense of wonder and curiosity that they shared with all of humanity, and that Anne continues to share through the TV series Cosmos and other efforts. After working as a writer and TV producer, Sasha has authored a book that surveys humanity's celebrations and rituals, finding science, wonder, and deep meaning. She visited the Society's new headquarters in Pasadena a few days ago and sat down with me in our studio. Sasha Sagan, thank you so much. It's always an honor to bring people here to the Planetary Society and sit across a table and talk with them. But after all, it's because of your lineage that we have this place to talk about across a table.
I'm so happy to be here. This feels very, very special.
And everybody else, as you've seen, is also thrilled to have you here today. We already
Thank
did
you.
The little tour. I hope you enjoyed walking
I loved
around.
It. I loved it.
You have this book, which I just finished reading for the second time.
Oh, thank you. Wow. Thank you.
I'm going to start by reading the blurb from our boss here, the
yes.
CEO, which happens to be on the back of the book. Bill Nye says, "What is the meaning of life? Sagan," that's Sasha Sagan, "finds its meaning everywhere with her family, around the world, and especially among the stars of the cosmos. Read her work. You'll have a deeper appreciation for your every step, every bite, and every breath." He has a way with words.
He certainly does, and I was so delighted and felt really a lot of gratitude when I got that blurb. That was wonderful.
But then you have a way with words.
Thank you.
As was also recognized, another blurb inside the book from the great Richard Dawkins. She's Carl Sagan's daughter, and it shows. But you are also Andruyan's daughter,
yes.
And it shows.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. I do feel like a product of both of my parents, and I feel extremely lucky to be the daughter of those two.
This is the most wonderful agglomeration of personal experiences, your own life, mm-hmm. remembrances, stories you've been told by others, mm-hmm. like your parents,
mm-hmm.
but also bringing in these cultural practices and rituals and celebrations from around the world and from throughout time. They're really well woven together.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It was, you know, the more that I was sort of researching celebrations and rituals, because a lot of the book comes from the idea of, if you believe that the scientific method is the pathway to understanding, and if you believe that belief requires evidence, how do you celebrate? How do you mark time? You know, you still have weddings, you still have funerals, kids still come of age, you still want to do something when it's cold and the nights are long. How do we sort of navigate this and still have the things that have brought us together and uplifted us and helped us process change throughout time, even though historically the infrastructure for a lot of that has been religion. And what I found that was so thrilling to me was that so many of the holidays and traditions and rituals around the world and throughout time, when you peel back all the specifics, the things that we're really celebrating are scientific phenomena. Birth, coming of age, death, these are biological processes, changing of the seasons.
As you said in the book,
yeah,
biology and astronomy,
exactly.
Which was the first big revelation of the book because it had always been there in front of me, but I never thought about it.
Thank you.
Why this title?
Oh, yes. So for small creatures such as we, it comes from a line in the novel Contact, which is the only work of fiction that my dad ever published. And like everything that my parents did, it was a collaboration. And it's actually my mom who came up with the words. The rest of the line is, "For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love." Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so much of what my parents taught me, is this idea of, if we're just this little out-of-the-way planet in this great, wide, vast grandeur, well, what do we have that can sort of help us not be in just a full-blown existential crisis all day long? And it's one another. And it's that feeling of falling in love, the love you feel for your kids, the love you feel for your friends, the feeling of being part of a community and being part of a species where even though we have these differences that seem important, they're not, and and we're really all in it together on this little out of the way rock.
Hear, hear. How did you come to structure it the way you did? As I said, it is this amalgamation of both the very personal and what is really spans all of humankind.
So the chapters, like there's a daily ritual and a weekly ritual. There are chapters like that. There's each of the four seasons. And then there's chapters that are about birth and coming of age and death. I just tried to take a little window into some of the things that are just innate to life on Earth and some of the things that are innate to our species. And the way that we mark time seemed like such a clear theme in so many of the holidays and rituals around the world. It's this way of processing time. It's so hard to feel it. Every second it's going by, it's like lying on the ground, I like to say, and trying to feel the earth rotate. It's just impossible, but it's happening all the time. I think we've created a lot of beautiful celebrations and rituals to try to feel time passing.
Another thought that I had as I read the book is that there must be, I mean, we now know, if you'll pardon the expression, there are billions and billions of planets across
yes,
the universe,
yes,
even in our own galaxy,
yes,
right? Among those billions and billions, there probably are a billion or more,
yeah,
that don't tilt.
Yes.
And what do those poor people do without
yeah,
seasons?
Well, yes, there are some places here where it seems like we don't have any seasons. but no, I mean, it's so true because it's so much about a book about being an earthling. It's just amazing, right? It's some collision at some point in our early history as a planet knocked us a little off. We got this 23-ish degree tilt. And because of that, the length of days change and we have seasons. They're the source of so much beauty. Facts kind of sometimes get maligned as cold and hard. And, you know, sometimes we learn these things in the abstract. We think, okay, the axial tilt, I just have to remember this for a test or whatever when you're growing up. But I think that if we can teach kids that this is the source of so much beauty and sort of get a thrill out of it, it might be, I don't know, it might encourage a little more scientific thinking.
I wasn't surprised to read at all that your parents, when asked about, you know, do they believe that aliens exist, mm-hmm, or is there life after death, they mm-hmm responded by saying, we don't know. But what was interesting is that you report how they responded. They gave that response with such joy.
Yes. When I read about this too, when I was little, if I could ask a question to which they didn't know the answer and we had to look it up or investigate it, that was like I had done something marvelous and I would like really celebrated for that. Sometimes we would go to the Britannica and we would find out the answer, and sometimes there were questions to which we don't know the answer, or, you know, we don't know the answer yet, or some things like life after death, to which each of us will in time get the answer. But the idea that it was okay to say, well, we just don't know, and that's great. You know, that's fine. It's better than coming up with an answer because we're so uncomfortable, or as my parents would say, unable to tolerate ambiguity. You know, I think they really instilled in me this idea that anyone who ever came up to my dad and said, like, do you believe in aliens? And he would say, well, I just don't know. So we don't have any evidence. And they would say, yeah, but like, what do you really think? And like, what does your gut say? And he would say, you know, something to the effect of, well, like, I try to use my brain and not my gut to determine these sort of things. And it's just a very, I don't know, I think it's so hard sometimes. We really struggle in everyday life, not even with like big philosophical questions, but just the feeling of not knowing is so hard. But I think it's something really useful and something that if we can try to get more comfortable with, we'll be better off.
And it drives so much of science.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And to find an answer that's real rather than a placeholder so that we're more comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get into the seasonal stuff here because you've got chapters about all the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the one about summer, I mean, this is a space show.
Yes.
So some people are saying, okay, let's talk about, about space.
Yes.
This is sort of moving in that direction. Summer seemed especially relevant for this conversation. We owe our lives to the sun.
Yes.
Clearly.
Yes.
More broadly, though, you review how light in general has always been regarded as sacred.
Yes, it's so true. I mean, so many celebrations and rituals and holidays have to do with a flame, with a candle, or I like to think of it as this little miniature of our sun. And, you know, there's so much sun worship throughout history, so many sun gods, especially in places close to the equator where the sun is part, you know, this double-edged sword part of everyday life. And it just makes perfect sense, right? If we're going to worship anything, certainly the star that we orbit that gives us so much and to whom, as you said, we owe our lives, it seems so natural. But what I found so fascinating was the idea that you know, an eternal flame at the gravesite of someone we admire, or a birthday candle, or in Judaism, there's something called a yahrzeit candle, which you light on the anniversary of someone's death. And they're just, of course, so many holidays revolve around making light in the wintertime. And it just seemed so, you know, when you take a step back, if you were to look at us from the vantage point of another species somewhere, you might think, oh, of course, this is how they celebrate. This is what they worship. They have this yellow star that's really meaningful to them.
And in fact, this all comes up, this discussion of the sun, in your chapter about anniversaries and birthdays. This idea that every time the Earth comes back around to roughly the same spot is a time to break out a birthday cake.
Right. It's so funny because it's so much a part of our lives that when it's the anniversary of something, an event, a birth, marriage, anything, a coronation, that's when you celebrate it. But it could be any time, but it's so astronomical that we do it when we're in the same position around the sun that we were when the thing happened. But of course, the whole solar system is moving and the whole galaxy is moving, so we're not really in the exact same place. But that's kind of like a perfect metaphor for what it feels like on your birthday, right? It's kind of the same. You have cake, you're with your friends or whatever, but everything's different because the year has gone by.
Yeah. You ever hear, this is sort of a semi non sequitur?
I'm open to all non sequiturs.
Isaac Asimov, the great science fiction writer, back in the 1940s, wrote this wonderful science fiction short story called Nightfall.
Mm.
And it was set on a planet where science was budding and they had great observatories, but they had never seen the night sky. Because the observatories were for studying their stars, because they had, I think, three or four stars. And because of this, there was always a star that was up in the sky over wherever you were on the planet. They didn't know what stars were. They had never seen the night, except that once every millennium or so, they all dip below the horizon and civilization goes utterly mad.
Wow. Oh, my God. I have chills. That is a great premise.
But it fits right in with what you're talking about, our attitude about light and about the light of the sun, the originator of all light, almost all of it.
And also this idea that right before we had control of fire and at night, you know, the stars and if you're lucky, a full moon was the only light, but also how much scarier that was, and what a visceral relief sunrise must be, and to be able to see what's in the forest, see what animals are around. That must have been so, not just, oh, it's nice that it's daytime, but just that relief of safety.
Yeah. Just switching gears a little bit.
Yeah.
Something disappointing that happens to me two or three times a year, probably, that some very nice person, sometimes someone I know well, sometimes a stranger, will either introduce me or ask if I've been an astrologer for long. Now, I'm a very poor astronomer,
no.
and I'm certainly not an astrologer, but I'd rather be a poor astronomer than the best of astrologers.
Yes.
And you believe with your parents, in spite of this, that we are connected to the cosmos.
Well, this is the thing. Again, talking about people who like sort of see themselves, describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, I think sometimes that category, you know, maybe they're very skeptical of religious doctrine that they were brought up with, but they're really interested. So, I mean, again, it's a generalization, but there is a theme where you sometimes see people who describe themselves that way to be who are really interested in astrology or crystals or other things that sort of fall into that category. And of course, because I believe that evidence has to. I'll put it this way: I withhold belief without evidence, so I'm not a big fan of astrology and crystals. But
extraordinary claims,
yes, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and I have yet to see any that support those things. But what I think is really important is I think that that urge and interest in those things comes from this desire to feel connected to the planet, to the universe. And I think a lot of people really want to feel that sense of their place in our world, in our universe, in this great vastness. And sometimes maybe they get a little sidetracked as to what the best way to do that is, or what the way that is most reflective of our understanding of science at this time. But I think that it's some of that desire could be repurposed into a deeper understanding of astronomy.
Couldn't agree more. And we still find such connections in the sky. We always have.
Yes.
I know you do too.
Yes.
In your chapter about autumn,
yes,
you go through all these other cultural visions of these patterns, random patterns of stars that we see in the sky. My favorite among these, the Mono people who live here in California, who when they looked up at the Pleiades, that beautiful little cluster of stars, they see a group of women who prefer
onions to husbands. Yes, that was a great one. I mean, right, constellations, right, they're such a reflection. I mean, the lines we draw between the stars, they're a reflection of what our hopes and fears are and what we are thinking about and what our culture emphasizes. We're always looking. I mean, our entire history as a species has been about looking for meaning up in the sky. And I think we're just in the last few hundred years, we're really getting a sense of what's up there and how we fit in.
In the end, is there advice you want to pass along? Or if you're not into giving advice, lessons you may have learned from just writing this book and living the life that led up to it?
Well, I would say this. The thing that really I hope to take away from this is whatever you believe, whether you're, you know, secular or religious or somewhere in between, that the idea that we are here right now, and it is really meaningful and beautiful and worthy of celebration, and we are in it together. There are ways to reflect your true philosophy in the way you mark time, in the way you celebrate, in the way you have holidays with your family, in the way you welcome a newborn. There's no need to go through the motions. You can do what actually reflects your deepest philosophy. And I think that in a way, the most traditional thing is the idea that human beings are trying to understand where we are and what it means to be alive on this planet. And we've been doing that long before we were doing anything else.
It's an exciting quest.
Yes, it certainly is. It certainly is.
Your mom told me how proud she is of you for creating this book. I absolutely agree with her. It is a wonderful work. I recommend it very highly. And thank you for coming in to talk to us about it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
The book is for small creatures such as we, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World, and its author is Sasha Sagan. Sasha and I talk about much more online. You'll find it at planetary.org/radio. Back with Bruce in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, I'm Jason Davis, Editorial Director for the Planetary Society. Did you know there are more than 20 planetary science missions exploring our solar system? That means a lot of news happens in any given week. Here's how to keep up with it all. The Downlink is our new roundup of planetary exploration headlines. It connects you to the details when you want to dive deeper. From Mercury to interstellar space, we'll catch you up on what you might have missed. That's the Downlink, every Friday at planetary.org.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Time for the barely pre-Halloween edition of What's Up. And we are joined by the Chief Scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts. Welcome.
Yay!
No, I think it should be boo.
It's Halloween time.
Speaking of spooky, you're just back from Washington, D.C.
always a spooky place to go. Yes, I was attending the International Astronautical Congress, the IAC conference, and giving a talk about preliminary results of Light Sail 2.
Still up above our heads as we speak, right?
Still up there, still flying, still talking to us, still doing some sailing. We're tweaking it here and there, and it's going.
I sure hear from lots of listeners who are thrilled to know that we did this and it's still going on. The mission continues. I wanted to share that with you as well. What else is up there?
Well, on spooky Halloween, if you pick this up in time, we've got a lovely sight with the moon in between Jupiter and Saturn, a crescent moon between Jupiter and Saturn. That will be low in the southwest in the early evening. Jupiter and Saturn will be hanging out there even after that. On the 2nd, the moon will be close to Saturn, looking yellowish. Saturn, not the moon. I mean, probably not. Maybe if it's smoggy where you are. And then in the pre-dawn east, very low down, is reddish Mars starting its ascent into the pre-dawn sky. And then Mercury transit, Matt. The last one for until the 2030s on November 11th. A rare transit of Mercury crossing the sun, going between the Earth and the sun. To observe this small disk crossing the sun, you're going to need a telescope with proper safety filters. Don't fry your eyes out, please. Well, we move on to this week in space history. Respectfully remember 1957, Sputnik 2 launched Laika the dog into space in the first space example of animal cruelty. But hey, it wasn't Laika's fault. Laika rocked. 1973, Mariner 10 launched. It would fly past Venus and then give us our first views of Mercury. In 2013, the Mars Orbiter mission launched from India on its way to Mars.
Wow. That's a long time ago, and it's still orbiting and still delivering science.
Yeah. All right, we move on to Space Fair.
I'm heading down a lion's drag strip. Thanks. Well, I did once a long time ago. It's been gone for many, many years.
You'll travel back in time and go. So here's your random space fact. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, you've probably heard of them. Until just before, relatively close to launch in 1977, they were known either as the Mariner Jupiter Saturn missions, or you could have even called them Mariner 11 and 12. But then the Voyager program was split off and they became Voyager 1 and 2 and went on to fame and fortune. They went on to fame.
Well, they delivered a fortune in data
and images, and the data continues. So yeah,
and
you're not
science.
Far off. Yeah, I'd read about that they almost were part of the Mariner series.
All right, we move on to the trivia contest. I asked you, what was the first star system besides our own found to have 8 planets? How'd we do, Matt?
We got a winner. I think our first one, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think our first one from South Africa. Sean Young believes that it is the Kepler-90 system was the first to be discovered that had 8 planets, which a lot of people believe is how many our own solar system has. More about that in a moment. He's correct?
He is correct.
Congratulations, Sean. We have a NIAC pin for you. That's the NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts Program out of NASA that we did a show on two weeks ago, to be precise, and a kick asteroid, rubber asteroid from the Planetary Society, along with the 200-point itelescope.net astronomy account.
Way to win. So Kepler-90, the parent star, is a G-type main sequence star, not that different than the Sun, and located about 2,840 light years from Earth.
Okay, we're ready to go on.
Back to Mariner 10, well known for Mercury, also flew by Venus, first to do a gravity assist like that to go from one body to another. But here's something you may or may not know until after the trivia question. What comet did Mariner 10 return data about in 1973? What comet did Mariner 10 return data about? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until Wednesday, November 6th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. And you probably won't be surprised to hear that whoever makes it through the process this time through random.org and has the right answer is going to get a copy of Sasha Sagan's book For Small Creatures Such as We. This terrific book that we've been talking about earlier on this program. I highly recommend it, as you've heard me say, along with a 200-point itelescope.net account from that great worldwide network of remotely operated telescopes. I bet they'll be looking at the Mercury transit with some of those, and you might be able to join in. Okay, now we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what costume you'd like Matt to wear for Halloween. Thank you, and good night.
Well, my 3.5-year-old grandson who had interesting choices for everyone in his life, what they're supposed to be for Halloween. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to need to have a gopher costume.
Oh, you would make such a fine gopher. I think you made an excellent choice.
Thank you.
I don't know why. You just would.
I'll pass that along. Thank you very much. I'm thanking there the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. It's Bruce Betts, who joins us every week here for What's Up. I love bringing back the spooky Halloween version of our theme song. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members, most of whom revere the name Sagan. Join them by visiting planetary.org/membership. Mark Hilverda is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, and this version came from Paul Burgell of Phantom Creep Theater, Coney Island, New York. Thanks again, Paul. I'm Matt Kaplan, Ad Astra.